agenda of the Third Reich. In the spirit of the White Rose, WPKN offers a weekly political calendar in order to give voice to the struggles of marginalized peoples. Here are the current listings.
The Committee for Peace in Israel and Palestine and East End Women in Black are pleased to present a unique Israeli view of the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza and the conflict between Israel and Palestine. On Monday, September 24th at 7 p.m., the film Arna's Children will be presented along with a discussion by Jeff Halper, coordinator of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions at the Unitarian Universalist Meeting House at 977 Sag Harbor Turnpike in Bridgehampton, Long Island. Arna's Children is Giuliano Murakami's documentary on his mother Arna, an activist against the Israeli occupation who founded an alternative education system for Palestinian children. The film is set in the Jenin refugee camp on the occupied West Bank. Kathy Engel of East End Women in Black will lead a discussion following the film. This event is free. For more information, call 631-259-2482. The Urban Rivers Conference, sponsored by the Connecticut Coalition for Environmental Justice, will be held from 8:15 a.m. to 4:15 p.m. on Thursday, September 27th at 10 Jefferson Street in Hartford, Connecticut. If you have any questions, please call 860-548-1133 or go to www.environmental-justice.org. The mission of Connecticut Coalition for Environmental Justice is to protect urban environments primarily in Connecticut through educating communities, encouraging changes in local, state, and national policy, and through promoting individual, corporate, and governmental responsibility towards our environment. On October 4th at 6:45 p.m., the newly formed community group Sustainable West Hartford will host the screening of the Connecticut Public Television documentary The Warming of Connecticut at the West Hartford Town Hall Auditorium located at 50 South Main Street. In The Warming of Connecticut, Emmy Award-winning independent documentary producer Jennifer Boyd, a West Hartford resident, examines the science behind global warming and seeks solutions at a local level. "The predictions are sobering, but the solutions are inspiring," says Boyd. Quote, unquote, "The documentary looks at changes taking place in our own backyards right now. It also highlights work being done throughout the state to combat global warming and offers ideas for individual action." By hosting this event, West Hartford joins communities across the country who are participating in a national conversation on climate action events on October 4th. Doors open at 6:15 p.m. and the program will begin at 6:45 p.m. with introductory remarks from West Hartford officials and members of the Sustainable West Hartford Community Group. Following the movie, the audience will be invited to break into smaller groups to discuss local climate action options. To inquire about the national conversation on climate action, please go to www.climateconversation.org or call Malaya Housenecht at 203-432-8823. The Connecticut Green Party's New Haven chapter meetings are held on the second Thursday of every month, 7:30 p.m. at the Never Ending Bookstore, 810 State Street in New Haven, Connecticut. For details, email nhgp@svcglobal.net or call 203-782-6808. Green Party members and friends get together every Wednesday at 7 p.m. at the Book Trade Coffee Shop, 1140 Chapel Street in New Haven, for informal conversation. To be included, call Alan at 203-782-6808.
To include your group's upcoming demonstrations, meetings, lectures, films, and boycotts in the listings of the White Rose political calendar, send information about national, regional, statewide, and local events at least 2 weeks in advance when possible to the White Rose Political Calendar, WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604, or You can send an email to whiterose@wpkn.net. Again, that's whiterose@wpkn.net. This week's calendar was produced by Merrill Collins and Chris Ferriero.
Stay tuned next for Counterpoint.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake. Birds, snakes, an airplane. Lenny Bruce is not afraid. I have a hurricane. Listen to yourself. Churn world. Set its own needs. Dummies serve your own needs. Beat it up a notch. Speak grunt. No strength. The ladder starts to clatter with fear. Fight down. High fire and a fire. Representatives have engaged in a government for hire. And a combat site. Left and west are coming in a hurry with the furies.
Welcome to Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris, here Monday evenings between 8 and 10 p.m. We're glad you could join us for another evening of discussion of some of the darker sides of what's going on in the world, with hopefully some solutions at the end of it. And we're very happy to have with us in just a moment on the phone line Greg Palast, BBC TV investigative reporter, talking to him about a couple of things that he's been investigating and reporting on. A little later on this evening, we'll be talking to Robert H. Frank, who's author of a brand new book titled Falling Behind, How Rising Inequality Harms the Middle Class. And inequality has certainly been a hallmark in the last couple of decades and increasing exponentially here. So that's something that we hope will be of interest to you. Later this evening, Jennifer Daskal of Human Rights Watch will be talking to us about the Senate's failure last week to restore habeas corpus to foreign prisoners being held by the hundreds in places like Guantanamo Bay Naval Base without charge or trial. And the Republicans filibustered and, as many of you know, prevented a vote from restoring habeas corpus. We'll be talking about the repercussions of that and likely next steps. And lastly, we'll be talking about national health care and the prospects for some movement on that issue in this 2008 upcoming presidential election season. We'll be speaking with Marilyn Clement from the group Healthcare Now. But right now, let me get on the air here. Greg Palast, a really good friend of this radio station. He's an award-winning BBC TV investigative reporter known to many of you for his best-selling books, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, and his most recent book, Armed Madhouse. Greg, thanks for being here tonight.
Thank you for letting me on.
Hey.
without any voltage, it's shocking.
Any voltage indeed. We'll be talking about that in a minute. The few issues I wanted to talk with you about, things that you've been writing on recently, of course, was your book that was the basis of some questions asked by an unfortunate college honor student, Andrew Meyer, in Florida. So we'll be talking about that, but maybe even more importantly, we'll be talking about the civil rights lawsuit that was launched the very same day and not much talked about in the press.
You'd be the first. You're about to talk about between the lines. Talk about under the line.
Yeah, well, I got the right guy to talk about it with right here because this is your...
Can we let the audience in on it? Okay, what's happened is that unless you're under a rock, you know that a Florida journalism student, Andrew Meyer, last week was hit with 50,000 volts several times by a taser from being held down by five cops. After he asked John Kerry some straightforward questions about why he caved in and conceded the election in 2004, despite the fact that millions of black voters had been disenfranchised, he was holding, and I think one of the things that Scott was doing is he was holding on to what the Washington Post called a mysterious yellow book, which happens to be my book, Our Madhouse, and actually, the student Meyer asked Kerry, you ought to read Our Madhouse by Greg Palast. And Kerry's response was, I've read it. And in fact, later he told the Boston Globe, there's a very important chapter in the book on the election. There sure is. It's called Kerry Won. And what the student wanted to know was, if you won, Mr. Kerry, that is, if we counted the black votes, you would have been president of the United States. Why did you concede those votes? And before he could get an answer, yes, he was pushy. He was a bit on the rude side, like all the interns, Porter Greg Palast, in fact. they grabbed him and zapped him. But the real important thing, and I bless you, Scott, for bringing this up. You are absolutely unique in the United States among journalists, radio journalists, to say that the real story is not the zapping of Andrew Meyer, but the fact that the very day he was talking about and was zapped for asking about the disenfranchisement of black voters in Florida, the NAACP filed a lawsuit against the state of Florida for disenfranchising black voters. That was not covered anywhere, and you are breaking the media omerta, and bless you. 20,000, just to know what was happening, 20,000 voters were illegally removed from the voting rolls of Florida. They knew registrants. Most of these were Haitian Americans. The governor of Florida, Republican, went to their swearing-in ceremony and said, it's great to have these new citizens at the swearing-in, they all get voter registration forms. They filled them out, and the Haitians filled them out, of course, as Democrats, for the most part, and they took the forms, and they threw them in the garbage.
Now, this was in the 06 election or the 04 election? I'm not quite clear on the year.
It's happening right now.
Yeah.
No,
oh.
This just happened. This just happened.
Okay, so this
and,
is for the current
this
election.
This just happened this year. This last year and this year. Some of these were registrations thrown out before the 2006 election. By the way, in Sarasota, the Congresswoman Catherine Harris's seat was retained by the Republicans by 300 votes because 18,000 votes in minority areas were lost in the electronic voting machines. So you have systematic disenfranchisement of African-American voters in Florida. He brought that up. In fact, you have to understand, Andrew Meyer is standing in Gainesville. This happened in Gainesville, Florida, which is Alachua County, and he brought up disenfranchisement in Alachua. I did a story in 2001 called Florida's Disappeared Voters for the Nation, in which I talked about, of the 5,000 counties in America, Gainesville, Alachua, is one of the absolute worst in terms of its Jim Crow treatment of the black voter. They are under, supposedly, U.S. Justice Department scrutiny for their practices, and we nailed them cold for illegally knocking out legal black voters. All Andrew Meyer was asking was why Kerry abandoned these voters. And it's a darn good question. And for all the fun and games about the tasing, no one's asked about it. And, of course, you, Scott, are the first one to bring up the point that the NAACP just filed a lawsuit about it.
Well, I have to confess, I did not find this on my own. I had a lot of help from you because I've heard you say something about this case, although you weren't...
That's legal. That's
yeah,
cool.
It works.
You're permitted.
Yeah. Well, you know, I appreciate all the work you do on these issues. And I guess the bottom line, when we're talking about the upcoming 2008 election, when it comes to suppressing the votes that you've well documented over the last couple of election cycles, what are the biggest issues that are potentially solvable now, you know, months before the November 08 election?
Well, there's two things. First, while a lot of activists are very concerned about voting by computer, and believe me, that's a creepy, ugly system. And as I just mentioned, that in Florida, the only reason the Republicans still hold the Sarasota seat is because the paperless electronic machines went zap and disappeared the votes in minority districts. But that's not the biggest problem. The biggest problem is exactly what the NAACP sued Florida over last week, which is knocking out registrations. This is below the wire. I mean, I'm going to be very blunt with you, Scott, on this, and it's going to make some people uncomfortable. The issue of electronic voting is a white issue. Most votes that are lost are black votes. The black issue is the right to register and the right to vote once you've registered. So it's not about the vote being stolen once you've pushed the lever. That's an issue. The big one is that these people can't even get, you know, voters of color cannot get registered. That is what they're doing, is they're using the new provision of what's called the, God forbid, the Help America Vote Act to block new voters. And what they did in Florida, they used this something called the verification list. This is brand new. Every Republican Secretary of State and some unfortunate Jim Crow-style Democrats, like in Georgia, are using systems where they say that you can't register to vote unless your name, you can fill out a form, but your vote won't count unless, and your registration won't be valid unless your name also appears on something called a verification list. Well, these verification lists, which are supposed to be kind of citizenship lists, don't really exist in America. We're not the Soviet Union. We don't have citizenship lists. So you have secretaries of state who make up these Mickey Mouse lists, and if your name... By the way, the ACLU noted that if your name is something like Mohammed or Juan, the chance that your name, or Jean Robert, if you're from Haiti, the chance that your name won't appear on a verification list is really high. So high that 3 million voters a year lose their vote this way under the new system. 3 million voters are losing the right to vote, but because it's mostly Haitians, Hispanics, African Americans, and the largest whacked group are Native Americans on the reservation, no one covers it. No one covers the damn issue at all. All you hear about is maybe a little squawk about electronic voting. Other than that, the fact that millions of voters of color are losing their right to vote just doesn't register at all in the U.S. press.
We're speaking with Greg Palast, award-winning BBC TV investigative journalist. His books, best-selling books, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy and Our Madhouse. Our Madhouse was the book that was referred to by Andrew Meyer before he was jolted by tens of thousands of volts in a taser assault by the police at the University of Florida for asking the wrong question to Senator John Kerry. And Greg's book was the basis of this incident, of course, as we well expect from our friend, the American British reporter here. So, hey, Greg, tell me something about this the Florida thing again. As I read the Miami Herald, it says the Florida law requires that a citizen's name on a voter registration form be matched with a Social Security number or a driver's license number. And, of course, as you said, Florida legislators made this change in their law to comply with the Help America Vote Act to secure registration, I imagine. Now, how is this being manipulated? And I know you've gotten to some of the details on this.
Yeah, well, a few things. Number one, who doesn't have a driver's license, rich folk or poor folk? Simple, right?
We know the answer.
The first thing you do is knock out people who don't have driver's license. Second, when they say Social Security, now, you have to understand, the Social Security Administration has no system for verifying people's citizenship status. So it's a phony. You say, well, we'll verify against a Social Security number. That don't mean squat. First of all, you can have a Social Security number and not be a citizen. All you have to do is work in America, and you can get a Social Security number as long as you're a legal worker. It's, once again, it's ways to knock out voters. Now a lot of people say, well, what's wrong with asking for voter ID? The answer is, in the 2004 election, a third of a million people were knocked out of voting, were prevented from voting because they didn't show up with the right ID or they were challenged on their ID. A third of a million. Now, it's, you go to jail for voting illegally. So were there a third of a million fraudulent voters? The answer is, as far as we can tell, we can't find a dozen. Not a third of a million. We can't find a dozen. And let me tell you, the Republican Party has been looking very, very hard. That's the entire basis of the firing of the prosecutors at Karl Rove's demand of the U.S. attorneys. People, U.S. prosecutors like David Iglesias in New Mexico, were basically told, look, we're knocking out tens of thousands of voters. You got to go arrest someone because to make this look good. Iglesias was a good Republican, a real political hound who wanted to do well by the Republican Party. But in the end, he and Bud Cummins of Arkansas and a few other stand-up U.S. prosecutors said, we're not going to just start arresting people to make your purge and block campaign look good. Basically, the Republican Party ran a massive block-the-vote campaign. They can't get the Haitian vote. They can't get the Hispanic vote. They sure as hell can't get the black vote or the Native American vote. And so their game is to block that vote, and they wanted U.S. prosecutors to make it look good. That's what's wrong with this ID game. People are not voting illegally, so there's no reason to ask them for any ID other than their signature, which is your legal affirmation that you are the voter you say you are. If you aren't, you go to jail. It's real, real easy to arrest people who are illegal voters because they sign their name, they give their address. Remember, if you're a registered voter, it's real easy to nail you if you voted for someone else. Real easy. We just don't have thousands of people saying, "Oh my God, I showed up and someone voted in my place." We just don't have those cases. They don't exist.
Well, I think the bigger scandal is the fact that there has been, you know, absolute silence on this this suppression of the votes campaign launched in the Justice Department and punishing those who wouldn't cooperate, as you talked about, with the firing of these U.S. attorneys. Since the resignation of Alberto Gonzalez, there has been just silence on this thing. And I don't know, you know, the U.S. press, by and large, is not getting into the nuts and bolts of this, at least I haven't read it recently, aside from what you've written, Greg, and it doesn't seem like the Democrats are doing a lot of investigation either, at least things that have come into the public light. So where is this thing headed? Because this potentially, to me, and maybe to you and many of our listeners, is one of the largest scandals of the last 7 years.
Indeed it is. And John Conyers, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, gets it totally. He's asked me to provide the evidence we've gathered from our madhouse, from BBC. He's asked for our material. We're giving it to him. His problem is, of course, is that Conyers, while chairman of the Judiciary Committee, is the dean of the Congressional Black Caucus, and the members of his committee are for the most part members of the Congressional White Caucus, and they are not interested in looking at the disenfranchisement of the black voter. The only white guy that I know, white politician, that has exhibited interest in this, well, I should credit Bernie Sanders, the socialist of Vermont. He's not a Democrat, but the only white Democrat I know is Bill Clinton, who I spoke to some weeks back. But I can't say his wife has picked up the issue. Clinton told me, look, we're going to use these prosecutor hearings to really bust open the disenfranchisement of the black voter. But we cannot get the active Congress people to take up this issue.
And I think what you said before, you know, about electronic voting machines certainly being an important issue that should be followed up on, and people should get active on those issues, making sure their votes are secure. But this seems to have a far wider impact on the results of elections.
Yeah, I mean, look, electronic voting is ugly business. We saw in Sarasota that can they steal elections through computers? You just saw it. There it was. It happened. Is that the number one? I mean, that's ugly enough. But unfortunately, that's not the number one issue. I wish I could say that that's all we had to worry about. The biggest single problem is the blockade of registration, the purging of registrations. You know, in 2000, I did the story of, you know, black voters purged as felons in Florida when their only crime was voting while black. And now we have even a more serious problem under a new law, Help America Vote, which supposedly was meant to protect voters. But, of course, you know, as soon as George Bush tells us he's going to help us vote, then we got to look out.
Yeah. Well, Greg, I guess, you know, you're not in the advocacy business necessarily. You're a reporter, an investigative reporter, and a damn good one. One of the best ones we don't have in America, since you're working for the British press. But
well, I want to correct that, actually, if you don't mind. Not that I want to pick a fight with you, Scott.
Okay.
There are plenty of really good investigative reporters in the United States. I can think of, you know, just, I don't want to insult anyone by leaving them out, Roger Trilling, Seymour Hirsch,
of course,
Appel, certainly Bob Perry.
Yes.
The problem we're running into is that we don't have investigative producers at the network. We don't have investigative editors. That is, we've got great investigative reporters. They're not allowed to report. I have to go to Britain to report these investigative pieces. Trilling goes to France. He's a reporter out of Los Angeles. Bob Perry was fired by the Associated Press and had to go out on his own. Seymour Hirsch was forced out of the New York Times, had to go to the New Yorker magazine with a British editor.
Right.
It's not easy, if you want to be an investigative reporter, to keep your job at a mainstream U.S. outlet. And in fact, today, I read Dan Rather's complaint. If you go to gregpalace.com, you'll see my very unpleasant comments about Dan Rather and his lawsuit against CBS. Because what Dan Rather said is Viacom, the owner of CBS, the CEO said, was enraged that my reports upset the White House, and therefore I agreed to be silent in return for an extension of my contract and let CBS retract the story about how George Bush dodged the draft. Now, I'd done that story myself on George Bush dodging the draft. It's in our madhouse. It's in my films. You can see them at my website for BBC. BBC, by the way, never retracted the draft dodging story. Dan Rather is probably one of the better souls out there, and he just grabbed his ankles and gave in to the media pressure. Others don't even try. I can't imagine Katie Couric even having to agree to be silent, because I don't think she'd ever speak up.
Yeah, that's a big problem right there. Yeah, and I know that Dan Rather, I guess, in some interviews he did in Britain, covered in one of your books, he really did speak out, saying that some of the things he said on British television he could never say in the United States for fear of his
right.
job. So he was honest, at least in Britain, not here, though.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he was straight up about it. He said, I cannot report stories without being, I can't ask tough questions of the president or of anyone without losing my job. In fact, being lynched. He called it just before he decided to do a serious report, which was on the president dodging the draft. I happen to be, while we're talking, I'm actually looking at the BBC program on George Bush dodging the draft, which we did, like I say, about a year before Dan Rather did his story. In fact, I first reported on it in 1999, before the first run of Bush for president. You can find the U.S. papers didn't touch it. They just simply wouldn't touch it.
Well, we're out of time, Greg. I'd love to have you back soon to talk more about some of the other things that you've been looking into. The Sheikh Abu Risha, who was recently assassinated, the guy who was supposed to be the honcho there.
George Bush's favorite Sheikh.
Right, who was killed.
The guy who sold us the surge.
That's right. He was cooperating with the U.S. military there and turning the tide, we were told again. But, well, we're going to have to wait to talk about that and some of the other things you're working on in the near future, Greg. Always great to hear from you, and especially on this issue of voter disenfranchisement, which you've been working on and thoroughly covering for years now, since the 2000 election. And
let me out of that story already. I just don't want them. I'm praying they don't steal the next election, because I just want to stop reporting this darn thing.
Well, I think you better start sharpening your pencils. It's going to be a long campaign season here.
Okay.
Many stolen votes, I fear. But thanks, Greg. And, I guess just to complete what I was about to say earlier, and that is you're not the advocate, you're the reporter. But I would certainly say this suppression of the voting scandal, you know, it's got to be on the top of a lot of our agendas when we talk to our congresspeople and demand that they look into this and uncover the nest of vipers there that have been stealing American citizens' votes. It's horrendous. It needs to be exposed.
And I'd like to see American reporters take on the topic. And I do appreciate that finally, for example, I got PBS, Petroleum Broadcast System, which has been really resistant on this story, through David Brancaccio and the program Now, Bill Moyer's old production. Did finally take on some of the investigations that I've done and put my story on the air. That's a rare business, though. It's the exception which explains the rule. And I have to say that that when Dan Rather and his producer Mary Mapes were fired for reporting the draft dodge story, which I had done, they were actually picking up another story of mine, which I was working on with them, on the disenfranchisement of voters, and that went straight out the window. as did the stories on Bush faking the story of weapons of mass destruction, which I didn't do. Other reporters did. But again, you know, when they got Dan Rather and he allowed himself to be gotten, that was the end of that was not just the killing of that one story. It was the killing of several. It was the killing of any chance for investigative reporting in America.
Well, it's something, I guess, it's hard to leave on that note, but we're going to have to, and I guess maybe we'll get fighting mad and try and all do something about it.
You got it,
which is required. All right, Greg, thanks again. Thanks for all you do.
Thanks.
Take care.
Bye.
And, oh, wait, your website, gregpalace.com. Read the text, see the videos. You've got a lot of great material there. People should go to gregpalace.com, right?
You got it.
Okay.
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks. Bye-bye. All right, Greg Palace, BBC TV investigative reporter. His most recent book is titled Armed Madhouse. The one before that, a New York Times bestseller, was The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. We're going to take a musical break. We'll be back with Robert Frank to talk about economic inequality here in the U.S. Stay tuned. This is WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM and WPKM in Montauk at 88.7 FM. My name is Scott Harris. The program is Counterpoint, and we're here every Monday evening bringing you information and analysis, commentary on a whole range of issues not ordinarily heard in the corporate media. And you can download each and every week's two-hour program free at the website whiterosesociety.org, whiterosesociety.org. And our friend Ben Birch catalogs, archives a whole bunch of progressive radio programs from around the United States. We're happy to be in that number, and it's available to you at that website. Again, that's whiterosesociety.org. Still coming up tonight, we'll be speaking with Jennifer Daskal of Human Rights Watch. We'll be talking about the effort in Congress, which failed last week to restore habeas corpus to detainees held at Guantanamo Bay Prison in Cuba. And a little later this evening, we'll be speaking with Marilyn Clement of the group Healthcare Now. We'll be discussing some of the features of the various presidential candidates' proposals for universal health care, most of them incorporating a private insurance role, as was the thing that we saw with Hillary Clinton back 14 years ago, and certainly different than many of the advocates for single payer. And we'll be focusing on the role of private insurance and single-payer government-run insurance, more like Medicare, with Marilyn Clement a little later tonight. So right now I'd like to welcome to the program Robert Frank. He's a professor of economics at the Johnson School of Management at Cornell University and a New York Times columnist. Robert Frank is the author of the books The Winner-Take-All Society, Luxury Fever, Choosing the Right Pawn, Passions Within Reason, and Principles of Economics with Ben Bernanke, the current chair of the Federal Reserve. And Robert Frank's latest book that we're going to be talking about tonight is titled Falling Behind, How Rising Inequality Harms the Middle Class. Thanks very much for being here with us tonight, Robert.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on, Scott.
Thank you. This book is, I think, well-timed because it seems that I think people are maybe finally waking up to the pervasive inequality that we're seeing and the growing inequality in our society. I kind of see it in small ways. But, you know, you quantify this for us and bring in a whole different dimension. And beyond the inequality, you talk about the whole kind of syndrome of keeping up with the Joneses, the super rich in this country, and how that is directly affecting the quality of life for the rest of us. But as we begin, Robert, tell us a little bit about kind of the landscape of America today in terms of rising inequality.
Okay, Scott, it's not a new thing so much, but it is a departure from the history we were accustomed to all through, let's say, from the end of World War II up through the early 70s. During those three decades, what we saw was a pretty constant rate of income growth across all the income classes, not quite 3%. Rich, poor, middle, it didn't seem to matter. Your incomes were growing at about the same rate during that period. Since then, though, there's been a huge shift. What happened was that most of the income growth stopped for most of the people, and the income growth that did occur was concentrated almost exclusively at the very top of the income ladder. The higher up you go, the bigger the growth rates of income. So let's say the top 1%, their incomes now are about three times as great as they were in 1979. People right at the middle, the median family earnings, have grown only about 15% since then. If you go up beyond the top 1%, though, that's when you see the really spectacular gains.
How does the United States today compare with other industrialized nations when it comes to economic inequality among its citizens?
An interesting question, one that I just had recently seen some new work on. What surprised me about it was that the pre-tax income inequality was not so different U.S. versus other countries. You know, we have the spectacular multi-million dollar salaries that we read about, and often the press accounts make it sound like they're unique to us, but pre-tax income in Germany is just about as unequally distributed as it is here. In Sweden, it's not much lower inequality pre-tax. The real difference across countries is in the after-tax distribution of income. Ours is by far the most unequal, and the countries in Europe have substantially lower after-tax inequality than we do.
That's a product, I imagine, of higher taxes on the very wealthy, which kind of is an equalizer. Is that right?
Yeah, it's a combination of things. It's higher taxes at the top. Yeah, we have the lowest tax rates on top earners of any country. But it's also a social safety net that's in place in most of those countries. They have, for the most part, single-payer health insurance. You were mentioning earlier the movements in this country that have been proposed don't include that. that's a big leveler. The school quality is much higher in most other countries for people in the middle and the bottom of the income distribution. There's public transportation. There's child allowances. There's a lot of other things besides the higher tax rates on top earners that lead to a much more equal distribution of income after tax and after transfers than we have.
When you look at the causes, the effect and causes of inequality in this country, what role has our tax policy and other policies of the U.S. government played in the growing numbers of or the growing gap between the rich and poor in this country since the late 70s?
Well, you know, inequality has been growing around the globe. Largely, that's because of market forces. Phil Cook and I in Winner Take All Society argued that markets have been getting much more competitive over time. We know who the best producers are now in every market. We know how to get in touch with them. It's cheaper to ship what they do over long distances. Oftentimes, what they do is just ideas, and so the ideas themselves can travel all around the world at the speed of light at no cost. So there's a lot of bidding for the best performers. They can extend their reach in a variety of ways more than in the past. And so if you have to bid hard to get the best performers to work for your side, then of course their salaries are going to go up sharply. And that's been going on, as I say, in every country. It's been maybe a little bit more pronounced in the U.S., but in other countries, the policy apparatus has leaned against that wind. Here, at least for the last 7 years, we've been pushing in the same direction as market forces. That's a very strange exception to the pattern we see world round.
And Robert Frank, I wanted to just quote something from your book. This is from the chapter, Smart for One, Dumb for All. And you write, there have been increases in the annual number of hours spent at work in the United States during the last two decades. Savings rates are at all-time lows. Personal bankruptcy filings are at record levels. And there is at least a widespread perception that employment security and autonomy have fallen sharply. At the same time, average house size and average vehicle weight have been growing rapidly. And, of course, this is really a key point in your book, that while a lot of people are getting in way over their head when, in terms of just overwhelmed by the expenses of everyday life, they're sticking their necks out more to buy more luxury goods. And I guess that's the crux of your argument here, is that there's something counterintuitive about what people are spending their money on.
Yeah, if you look at the psychological studies on the determinants of well-being, what they seem to suggest is that time with family and friends helps, being free of debt helps, not commuting long distances through heavy traffic, that helps too. Having a little bit more autonomy at work is known to be a factor that's conducive to well-being. Virtually all the movements that we've seen in the U.S. over the last 30 years have been movements away from those well-being promoting conditions and towards ones that are associated with greater stress, greater risk of illness, and premature death. It's an interesting trade. What we've been getting in return for it is bigger houses. So the median new house built in the U.S. now is about a third bigger than it was in 1980, even though the median family doesn't earn appreciably more than it did then. So it's an interesting trade. We're trading things that the evidence suggests doesn't matter for promoting happiness and well-being and health, in exchange for things that are known to threaten those qualities. So we're not measurably better off. In fact, we seem to be making a trade that is ill-advised on the basis of the best evidence.
So as the near-rich try and copy and keep up with the super-rich, this kind of cascades down the line to the middle class, where everybody has to step up to keep up with the Joneses, and it really impacts on people's quality of life. And in terms of the psychological underpinnings of this whole kind of zeitgeist in the U.S., what do you ascribe it to?
You know, I think there's not so much an effort to keep up with the Joneses. I think that has a pejorative ring to it. If you're in a place and people are living according to a certain standard, that's sort of the standard that people aspire to. I was, for a couple of years, a Peace Corps volunteer in Nepal. I lived in a small rural village, and the house I lived in had a grass roof. It leaked if it rained hard. It didn't have any plumbing or electricity. It was a house that for not one instant ever seemed unsatisfactory to me in that context. It was, by local standards, actually quite a nice house. I never psychologically yearned for a better one. It just seemed totally like it met every demand one could reasonably have for a house in that context. But someone here would be ashamed to live in a house like that. You know, their children wouldn't want their friends to know where they lived. It would just be something that would be an occasion for great personal discomfort to live in a house like that, just because I think the context suggests that normal people don't live like that here. And so if you're a rich person, well, you have your circle. I think people are too quick to get angry at the rich for building elaborate mansions and the like. But, you know, in that circle, that's what's seen as normal. And when they have more money, of course, they spend more. That's what you do. That's what I do, too. Poor people do the same. They've been getting all the income growth, so naturally they're building bigger. And as you say, the people just below the top, they're influenced directly by what the people at the top do. People in the middle don't much care. There's no sign at all that they're resentful of what people at the top do. The people in the middle are actually taking interest in the mansions and the yachts. They want to see pictures of them. They don't shake their fists. They don't get angry. But the people just below the top, when the people at the top build bigger, that shifts their frame of reference in a subtle way. So maybe now it's the custom to have your daughter's wedding reception in the home rather than a hotel or a club. And so people just below the top, they're in that same circle, so they build bigger. And then the people they overlap with just below them, they build bigger too. And that's the cascade that's really put pressure on the median family to feel it needs a bigger house. And the problem for them is if they don't buy the same price house as people of their income level do, then they've essentially consigned their children to go to below-average schools because of this link that we see in this country, at least, between how much your house costs and how good the schools are in the neighborhood where you live.
We're speaking with Robert Frank, professor of economics at Cornell University and author of the new book, Falling Behind, How Rising Inequality Harms the Middle Class. And I wanted to ask you about a table that you have in the book, Society A and Society B, different choices about different size homes versus stepping down a little bit, a smaller house, but more leisure time, you know, having evenings free outside of work to see your friends, that kind of a set of choices. And maybe you can explain the various choices people make and the kind of origin of this table.
It's just an attempt to summarize what some of the behavioral evidence suggests about determinants of well-being. And the organizing feature of the table is to compare two worlds across lots of dimensions. In one dimension, it's always a big house in one world and less of something else. You know, big houses cost money to make. If you build smaller ones, you'll have some extra resources that could be used in other ways. So the various entries in the table are all of that ilk. They're pairs. In one world, there's a big house and less leisure time. In the next category, there's a big house and less autonomy on the job and so on. What we know is that once houses grow beyond a certain size, if everybody gets a bigger one, that doesn't create much bang for the buck. It just seems to shift the bar that defines how big a house people feel they need. So you can cut back, let's say, from 4,000 to 3,000 square feet if everybody did it and not experience any sense of loss at all psychologically or physically or in any other way that counts. The resources that you free up in the process of doing that would support a whole lot of other possibilities, such as a shorter commute to work. That's known to make people better off. More leisure time to spend with family and friends. That's been shown to improve health and happiness. And a whole variety of other factors. So, yeah, we've been spending more on things, all of us, that don't seem to improve well-being and taking resources away from the categories that do seem to promote well-being.
Robert Frank, you performed an experiment with your children about orange juice. You want to tell us about how that relates to the bigger picture we're talking about here in terms of economic inequality and people's desires for luxury goods over maybe more practical comforts?
Yeah, there's always been an interesting debate about the extent to which people learn to react to contextual cues that tell them they need something versus whether it's hardwired. I think there's some very provocative literature suggesting a hardwired link, but for me, the the experiment that convinced me that it's not something we teach our children was the one you mentioned in the book. It was one I did with my two older sons when they were little, age 7 and 5. And on the first day, I gave them each a full glass of orange juice. They sat and drank it without comment. On the second day, it's a three-day experiment. On the second day, I cut them back to a half a glass each, thinking, all right, what will happen now? Will they complain? There wasn't a peep. They both drank their half glass without comment. Then on day three, the payoff day, I gave David, who was 7 at the time, 7/8 of a glass of orange juice, and Jason, who was 5, 3/4 of a glass. So just a barely noticeable difference. And you could see Jason looking back and forth between his glass and his brother's. He just seemed to sense that it was going to play out well for him if he complained, but finally he just didn't seem able to restrain himself any longer. He blurted out, "That's not fair. He always gets more than me." And so that was the cue for me to give my little talk about paying attention to your own business. You know, there's always more. If you want more, ask for it, blah, blah, blah. And I'm absolutely certain that no one ever taught him to complain that someone had more than he did. It's just the kind of thing I think that people are attentive to. You know, it's a competitive world we evolved in. People who cared about not falling too far behind probably were more likely to survive in the times we evolved. Famines were fairly frequent. How am I doing is a question you need to ask yourself. And if you're falling too far behind, it's good to feel motivated to take steps to try and recover your position in the queue.
Robert Frank, we're seeing a real kind of implosion of the housing market. The subprime mortgages are kind of blown up. And there's a lot of concern for the economy overall going into this next year.
Uh-huh.
What, if any, role do you think the topic you discuss in this book has to do with that? I mean, I, of course, see a link in terms of the subprime loans. People are desperate to get that house, even if maybe they can't afford it. And something's driving that. They're in over their head, and there are consequences that are being paid right now where people are losing their homes or having to go get a fifth job to just make ends meet or sending their kids out to work. I don't know what's going on out there. I'm not, you know, very fortunately, I'm not in that position, but millions of Americans are. And I
think there's a lot of finger wagging, oh, you should have known better. But every time the credit industry has made it easier to buy a house, when we bought our first houses, you needed to have 20% down. They wouldn't talk to you unless you did. Now people buy houses with no money down. Interest only sometimes even reverse equity mortgages if you have equity. The conditions to buy a house have gotten easier and easier. Well, what's been the effect of that? There's a nice book a couple of years ago by Elizabeth Warren and her daughter. They wrote it jointly. It was called The Two-Income Trap, and it was an explanation of why is it that we have two parents working in the family now. We used to have one, and yet families feel more strapped now than before. And the short answer, they suggested, was that every extra nickel of salary went into the bidding war for houses in better school districts. And I think that's what's happened every time they've liberalized credit conditions. You know, every parent wants his child to go to the best possible school, and if you can buy a house with fewer dollars down now than in the past, that means you can buy a more expensive one. And what that means is that others are bidding for better houses, so if you don't, your kids are going to go to schools where the kids score in the 20th percentile. And if you're the median earner, that's not going to be a comfortable thought for you. You'll join the bidding, too. But here's where we've ended up, as you point out. You know, we've got families being foreclosed now and, you know, dog days ahead in the housing market.
We're speaking with Robert Frank, professor of economics at the Johnson School of Management at Cornell University and author of the book we're discussing tonight, Falling Behind, How Rising Inequality Harms the Middle Class. This is WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM and WPKM in Montauk at 88.7 FM. My name is Scott Harris. The program is Counterpoint. And before we say goodnight, Robert, I just had a couple additional questions.
Sure.
And that is maybe just sort of isolate for us how exactly the inequality is harming the middle class, the title of your book. quantify that for us, if you would.
You know, if you wanted to send your child to an average school in 1980, you bought a 1,600 square foot house. Today, to achieve the same goal, your house had better be 2,100 square feet. This, I'm speaking averages for the U.S. now. That's a lot more money to round up to pay for a house than you used to have to. And if you're not earning more money than before, how do you do it? The answer seems to be that you work longer hours, commute longer distances. You do without things like retirement savings, if it means scraping out your savings account to meet the down payment requirement for a house in a good school district. Parents don't want to do that, but if the choice is, the alternative is to keep saving for retirement and watch your kids go to a bad school, most say no. No, they won't do that. So I think it's hard to step back from that if you're a parent. And I think unless the society acts collectively in ways like other countries around the world have acted to stem the increase in inequality, we're going to see this continued pressure on people in the middle.
Well, that brings me to an important question here is, in terms of dealing with this and confronting this growing inequality in the United States, you propose a consumption tax. Tell us about what that consumption tax would look like and the desired effect you hope would result from it.
Sure. I mean, my diagnosis of the problem is that the people in the middle are feeling pressure primarily because of the extra spending at the top, which in turn has launched this expenditure cascade that we talked about. So, I mean, you can't say to the people at the top, don't spend your money. That's, you know, it's a free country. If you've earned your money, you're entitled to spend it as you please. We can, however, adopt a different tax structure that would discourage spending on consumption at the top. So what I advocate in falling behind is to abandon the income tax altogether, just throw it out, and instead adopt a very steeply progressive consumption tax. And it actually sounds hard, but it's a pretty easy tax to administer. You would report your income to the IRS the same as you do now. Then you would also report how much you saved during the year. And we've learned how to do that in the process of administering 401k retirement accounts. You just document your savings for the year. So we know how much you earned. We know much how much you saved. The difference between those two numbers is how much you spent. So, for example, if you earned $100,000 and saved $20,000, then you spent $80,000 this year. And it's that amount less some standard deduction that you'd be taxed on. And the rates would be very small at first, so low-income families who don't spend much wouldn't pay much tax under this proposal. But then as the amount you spend each year grows, the rate on additional spending would also grow, and it could grow much more sharply than the progressivity of the income tax, and indeed it would have to in order to maintain the same tax burden across families as we have now. You could even have a 200% tax rate on consumption over, let's say, $4 million a year, so that when the time came to decide whether to build that extra wing on the mansion, there'd be a very strong incentive for you to instead put the money into a tax-free savings account and have it be there in case you really needed it someday rather than spend the extra money on the mansion. And if everyone did that at the top, then people wouldn't feel they needed a bigger mansion. So at one stroke, we would simultaneously increase national savings. We had a negative savings rate last 2 years. We can't go on like that. And we would also stimulate economic growth in the process. And we would also slow the expenditure cascade that's making people in the middle feel poorer.
So the cascade would go in reverse, is what you're
talking exactly about. Well, I mean, I don't think we want to absolutely reduce spending at the top. It's been growing very rapidly. And so my proposal would be to phase in this consumption tax gradually, make it more progressive as you phase it in, with the aim of slowing the growth of expenditure at the top, thereby slowing the strength of this expenditure cascade that's making life so tough on people in the middle.
And what other nations in the world have a consumption tax that looks something like what you've proposed?
You know, there are other nations that have exemptions for retirement savings. The U.S., actually, in the Senate, there was a proposal in 1995 to adopt such a tax. Milton Friedman sent me a nice letter and an article that he himself had published urging the country to adopt a tax like that during World War II. It's been discussed a lot historically, and if you take the large national sales taxes that the European countries have and couple those with their very progressive benefit structures, the net effect of all that combined is like a progressive consumption tax, but it's really much simpler to make the tax itself progressive, and that's why I propose it in the form I have.
Now, what about the trends in Europe? We're running out of time here. I know you and I both have to move on to other things, but this is fascinating. I'm so glad you could make time for our interview tonight.
Yeah.
But it seems that, you know, Nicolas Sarkozy was elected in France recently, preaching kind of like the American line in many ways. I don't think he's proposed a wholesale, abrogation of the French social safety net structure or their single-payer health care program.
Interesting to see the French reaction.
But he is certainly crossing some lines there we haven't seen before in Europe. And I'm wondering if you're seeing trends there where, with relatively higher unemployment in Europe than there is in the United States,
right,
that they're going more towards the kind of, Reagan-esque economic model than, their post-World War II social safety net model.
Yeah, there is some pressure. You see, in France, they've got the UK right next door, and there are a lot of people leaving France for the UK because the tax burden in the UK is lower. Even more important, I think, is that the regulatory burden in the UK is lower than in France. In France, starting a business is a bureaucratic nightmare. There's so much to contend with compared to in the UK. And so I think there is competitive pressure on France to try and offer terms that can make a more attractive business climate relative to England than they've managed to have so far. For us, we are by far the lowest total tax burden of any place. And so I think we're not under competitive pressure at all like that. On the contrary, we're sort of at the other extreme. So we've got quite a bit of room to maneuver. I think the nice thing about the progressive consumption tax is that it would become a magnet for rich people. Rich people are actually good to have if they don't spend too much. If you can come and shelter your income in savings, people who are rich now die with plenty of savings as it is, so why would they want to? They seem to enjoy accumulating large amounts by the time they die. It's a matter of keeping score, perhaps. And having people invest their money, save their money here in this country would be a big advantage for us.
Well, all this sounds, like it's practical, and any bites yet from presidential candidates, people in Congress looking at your proposals here that might bring this into the realm of practical politics and getting legislation passed?
I did go in April to speak to the Democratic senators at their issues retreat that they hold periodically. And, I think nobody's rushing to talk about taxes in general. I think they're probably wise in the current climate to keep their thoughts to themselves about the details of tax policy, at least until the thing gets sort of hammered out more fully. But, it's a tough rhetorical climate to operate in. If anybody proposes raising any tax, then immediately you're hammered with, oh, he thinks the bureaucrats in Washington know how to spend your money more wisely than you do. And so I think in that climate, you've got to be fairly circumspect. But if you can get people's attention long enough, I think voters seem ready to endorse the idea that we have important things to pay for, that we don't have the money in hand to pay for without higher taxes. And so, I think the day is coming when we're ready to have that conversation. We really have to be more prepared to ask how we as a society want to spend our money. It's not your money just because you earned it. You have a responsibility to pay taxes to help support the communal effort we have to exist and prosper as a country. So in addition to me deciding how to spend my after-tax income, of course I have the right to do that, we have to have a conversation about how we want to spend our communal resources, the ones we contribute to spend for the common good. And it's that second conversation we haven't been able to have in the anti-tax rhetoric days.
And you think that a progressive consumption tax would enable this country, for instance, to implement a universal health care system more easily than under our present tax structure?
It's the easiest source of new revenue, if you think about it. You know, for the whole upper tier to postpone building the next wing on a mansion going from 60,000 to 80,000 square feet, if they wait and don't do that for now, that's money saved and no cost to anyone. That's all money that's available to use for purposes that would suit the rich and the people in the middle and the people at the bottom more fully than just pushing the arms race that redefines how big a house you need to have a little further.
Well, Robert, thanks. Frank, thanks so much for being here with us tonight. And is there any web address or information you want to leave with our listeners how they can find out more?
Sure.
Beyond picking up the book itself, again, titled Falling Behind, How Rising Inequality Harms the Middle Class.
Yeah, I'll say that if you want more information about my writings generally, my website is a good place to start. It's www.robert-h-frank.com. And the book itself is available at Amazon and other sources. And the nice thing about the book is it's short. It's 125 pages long. And I've always asked people, why aren't there more short books? And I've yet to hear an interesting answer to that question.
The paper mills are making out.
That's right.
All right, Robert, thank you so much again for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on, Scott.
Take care. Bye-bye. Robert Frank again. Title of the book, Falling Behind, How Rising Inequality Harms the Middle Class. Robert's website, robert-h-frank.com. We're going to take a musical break. We'll be back with a discussion of the Military Tribunals Act and efforts to reform that, restore habeas corpus to detainees held by the United States in places like Guantanamo Bay Detention Center. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a couple of moments. Their song, To Hell with Poverty. This is WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM, WPKM in Montauk at 88.7 FM. If you'd like to contribute to this listener-sponsored radio station, speaking of poverty, You can go to our website and contribute securely online at www.wpkn.org. That's wpkn.org. And we have our schedule there and lots of other things about the radio station that will inform you of what's happening here each and every day and off the air as well. So thanks. And we're going to be going right now to an interview conducted earlier this evening with Jennifer Daskal of Human Rights Watch. So we'll do that right now. We have a discussion on universal health care coming up in about 25 minutes or so. So stay with us. This is Counterpoint. Stay tuned. We're speaking with Jennifer Daskal, Advocacy Director at Human Rights Watch in their U.S. program. Jennifer, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Last week, on September 19th, Senate Republicans sustained a filibuster that prevented a vote on the Habeas Corpus Restoration Act of 2007. The bill would have restored the right of U.S. detainees held on suspicion of involvement in terrorist-related activity to challenge their imprisonment in court, a right that had been canceled by the 2006 Military Commissions Act. Every Senate Democrat and six Republicans voted for the bill, while Senator Joe Lieberman of Connecticut, our state here, voted against it in a 56-43 vote. I wonder, before we get into the particulars of that Senate debate and loss of an opportunity to restore habeas corpus, tell our listeners a little bit about the current status of military commissions for detainees held at the Guantanamo Bay U.S. Naval Base in Cuba.
There's 340 detainees who are still being held in Guantanamo, most of whom have been there for close to 6 years at this point. Not a single one of those detainees is currently charged before a federal court, a military commissions, or any court of law whatsoever. They've all been declared to be what are known as enemy combatants on the president's say-so, but there's no formal charges pending against a single one of the detainees. So far, the military commissions have secured just one guilty verdict by a plea of David Hicks, who's now in Australia serving his relatively short 9-month sentence. The commissions that had started again last spring were dismissed when the military judges in the two cases concluded that the commissions did not have jurisdiction over the defendants, and those cases have been appealed to an interim appellate court at the moment.
So really, the military commissions, although put into place by the last Congress back in 2006, about a year ago, they really haven't moved forward with these military commissions. And I guess I want to explore, you know, what may be pending before the U.S. Supreme Court on this very issue. But maybe first tell us a little bit about your view of the impact of this filibuster, this Republican filibuster, that effectively stalled or stopped the effort to restore habeas corpus to these detainees.
Sure. I mean, because of the fact that there are so many detainees who remain in custody who have never been charged with any crime and never been told in any detailed manner the basis for their detention, it's absolutely essential that these detainees have a chance to go before an independent court and ask the government to provide the legal and factual justification for their detention. And that's what habeas is about, is ensuring that the executive branch has to put forward some justification for the detention of individuals, so that the executive cannot simply place people in prison, incarcerate them, and throw away the key. This is incredibly important given the kind of war, the kind of fight that the United States is in right now. This is not a war where the United States is picking up soldiers from an army that are wearing uniforms where it's clearly easily identifiable who the enemy is. This is a situation where the so-called enemy blends in with the civilian population, and it's absolutely essential that there's a second set of eyes, another check, to make sure that in this type of situation, the United States is not detaining the wrong people, but it's detaining who it says it's detaining.
we've read press reports that talk about that many of those detainees held in Guantanamo are in fact people who were picked up by bounty hunters when the U.S. first invaded Afghanistan, where the U.S. was providing quite hefty sums of money in exchange for the turning over of individuals that were involved with Al-Qaeda or in other ways involved in terrorism. But some of these people were clearly just marked by people who were greedy to get the reward money. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. The United States military actually only picked up an estimated 5 to 10% of the detainees who ended up in Guantanamo Bay. A significant portion were turned over by bounty hunters, by other armies, in many cases for large sums of money. And in fact, the United States was distributing bounty flyers, offering rewards for turning in terrorists or members of Al-Qaeda. And so in a situation like that, the possibility of getting the wrong people is very high. And there's another issue here, which is in terms of the broader U.S. counterterrorism policy. The continued detention of hundreds of young men in Guantanamo really has served as a rallying cry, of a symbol of the United States' excesses around the world. And if anything, it's served as a recruitment tool and a way for the enemies of the United States, something for the enemies of the United States to point to as a symbol of the United States' excesses in this fight and reasons, and serves as a means for gathering and recruiting other terrorists to the cause. And purely from a counterterrorism perspective, it's absolutely essential that the United States justifies the basis for detaining these men that are in its custody.
Jennifer, comment for us, if you would, on the reports that at least one military prosecutor abandoned some cases that he had against detainees due to the fact that he felt torture was used to extract confessions, which were the primary source of evidence for these military commissions that were to go forward.
Well, the use of torture and coerced evidence is a huge problem, and it's one of the reasons why, in fact, I think we've seen so few commissions move forward. In fact, only one move forward to date. Is much of the evidence that's been gathered against the detainees has come from other detainees and interviews that are taking place in highly coercive settings. We know that some of the interrogation tactics that were used included waterboarding, mock drowning, forced standing for days on end, for long periods of time. That's highly painful and abusive. Sleep deprivation that causes mental functioning to break down. All practices that the United States has condemned when carried out by others, and all practices for which the United States has prosecuted others when carried out against U.S. personnel.
We're speaking with Jennifer Daskal. She's Advocacy Director at the U.S. Program at Human Rights Watch, and we'll be giving out a web address so you can get more information about what the group is doing and other human rights groups are doing in regards to the Military Commissions Act and efforts to restore habeas corpus. Jennifer, recently appointed Defense Secretary Robert Gates, pretty early on in his tenure at the Pentagon, talked about closing Guantanamo Bay Detention Center. What happened to that move by him, and even some acknowledgement by President Bush that Guantanamo should indeed be closed down? It hasn't, of course, as yet, and the new Congress really hasn't taken any action to do that, to force the closure of Guantanamo.
I think what we saw with Secretary Gates' comments are a growing recognition that the continued detention of hundreds of men in Guantanamo has really undermined the United States' standing around the world and the United States' moral authority. And it's Secretary of Defense Gates, along with Secretary Rice, who go out in the world and try to argue for the United States' continued leadership role around the world. And the continued operation of places like Guantanamo really undermines, in a lot of ways, their ability to carry on their work in certain places. We have, as you've said, not seen, however, any real action towards making that goal a reality. We have seen the numbers of detainees in Guantanamo slowly be whittled down. But we still, there still are over 300 detainees left in Guantanamo. And there needs to be a concerted effort by the administration, by Congress, and both in terms of finding a solution for the detainees within the United States and also working with United States allies around the world to help find places to resettle detainees who are not, who cannot be sent back to their home country.
Is not one of the problems of closing Guantanamo Bay the fact that the United States wants to extract certain conditions from countries where some of these detainees may be repatriated? We look at the Hicks case, and it seems that the United States wanted him imprisoned for a certain period of time, wanted him silenced with regard to his contact with news reporters. There are some nations that are just not willing to sign on to those kinds of conditions to take some of these detainees back. And otherwise, I'm sure there are nations who are fearful of who these people are and just don't want them back in their countries, period. So maybe you could just summarize for us anything I left out of that and, how big an obstacle is repatriation in terms of closing Guantanamo down?
Right. Well, the Hicks case actually was slightly different because it was a plea agreement that Hicks himself signed into. So it wasn't an agreement with the Australian government. But you're absolutely right that the repatriation of the detainees poses huge problems, one of which is the fact that some countries don't want the detainees back. There's a problem that in some instances the United States is not satisfied by the security guarantees provided by the country, is concerned that a detainee who's released will not be under sufficient surveillance or will not be detained and could, in the eyes of the United States, go back to the battlefield. And then there's also a real concern about humane treatment, and the United States has made the right choice in several cases, mostly a group of 17 Chinese Uyghurs who are an ethnic minority from China, not to send them back to China because of fear that they would be tortured and subject to severe abuse upon return. And the United States has been, as far as we know, actively looking for third-party countries to accept these Uyghurs, but to date has not found a third-party country willing to resettle them. And unfortunately, the United States has also not been willing to resettle these detainees into its own country, despite the fact that they have long been cleared for release.
And Jennifer, in talking about the United States' decision, the Bush administration's decision to maintain Guantanamo Bay and hundreds of detainees still held there, President Bush talks about the fact that he sees these prisoners as the worst of the worst, although they have not been proven to be a party to terrorism in any way, shape, or form in any court of law or even a military tribunal. But at the same time, Bush maintains that, you know, in order to protect the United States, in order to get these people who are a danger to our society out of circulation, we have to keep them there in Guantanamo. How do you respond to the kind of vague argument that that keeping a place like Guantanamo open helps make the United States more secure?
Well, I think that the problem with Guantanamo, and it's a problem that I think Secretary of Defense Gates recognized, is that it's really served as a symbol of the United States' excesses in the fight against terrorism, and it's served as really a black eye on the United States and is something that's pointed to all around the world by other nations and by terrorist recruiters as a example of the United States' lawlessness.
So we really don't have any kind of tangible way of knowing if indeed Guantanamo and its establishment has kept this nation safer.
No, I mean, there's certainly no proof that that Guantanamo has kept this nation safer, and I would argue the opposite, that the detention of a few hundred young men who may harbor some resentment towards the United States is actually done more damage to the United States than a sound policy of actually going after the real organizers and planners and financiers of 9/11 and bringing them to a court of law where they can be prosecuted and held publicly accountable for their crimes. What we've seen instead is the world condemning the system of detention rather than the terrorists themselves.
Jennifer Daskal, the United States Supreme Court has ruled already in some of the cases related to the detention of prisoners at Guantanamo. But what are we waiting for now in terms of other related cases that could determine the fate of President Bush's detention program there at the naval base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba?
All right. Well, the Supreme Court actually took a really interesting turn this summer. It was asked to review a decision by the D.C. Circuit, one of the highest appellate courts, saying that affirming the Military Commissions Act stripping of habeas, saying that it was constitutional to strip detainees of their right to go to court to file a habeas claim. And the Supreme Court originally last February said we're not going to consider that case. And then in a fairly surprising turnaround, the United States Supreme Court this summer said, actually, we've changed our mind. We are going to hear this case. It's incredibly unusual for the Supreme Court to change its mind in that fashion. And this fall, there will be arguments before the Supreme Court about whether or not the provisions that strip detainees of habeas are, in fact, constitutional. And there's widespread speculation that the Supreme Court changed its mind because it became growingly skeptical of the constitutionality of the habeas stripping provisions.
With President Bush's appointment of very conservative justices to the Supreme Court, do you believe that upholding habeas corpus will be any greater problem for the advocates of restoring the right of habeas this time around in future decisions?
Well, again, I think the Supreme Court reversed course, and before a case to get up to the Supreme Court, there needs to be 4 votes in favor of hearing the case. We know that there are at least 4 votes that are in favor of restoring habeas. And so the assumption is, or at least my assumption is that one of the 4 votes decided to vote against hearing the case because they were afraid of losing and afraid of the precedent that was set. And at some point over the summer, there was a shift. And my belief, my hope, and again, this is based on, absolutely no inside information. There's no way to get inside of the negotiations that go on in the Supreme Court. It's really a black box. But that Justice Kennedy, who really is a swing vote on this issue, may have had a change of heart, and that as a result of that, the fourth justice, who had previously voted against hearing the case, decided that it was worth taking the risk and bringing this case up at this time.
Jennifer Daskal, I just wanted to bring up the case of Jose Padilla. Of course, he wasn't imprisoned at Guantanamo Bay. He was declared an enemy combatant, however, and he is a United States citizen. He was held in a military brig for some time, and then through the courts, he was tried in a civilian court. Tell us a little bit about the kind of murky issue of enemy combatants and U.S. citizens, and could George W. Bush's president declare any one of us as U.S. citizens enemy combatants and consign us to a military prison somewhere without charge or trial?
Yes, the administration asserts that it has that power. As a U.S. citizen, you and I would be able to file a habeas claim. That's the one key difference. But we could still be held in a military brig as an enemy combatant. The process of actually getting into court to file a habeas claim can take quite some time. And so the administration's been very clear in its position that it can detain anyone, including U.S. citizens, as an enemy combatant. And it's also been very clear that it can detain any non-citizen as an enemy combatant, including any one of the 11.6 legal immigrants living in the United States. And those individuals would not ever be able to get into court to file a habeas claim or to seek any sort of review of the basis of their detention.
So that has not been settled in court. Are there any outstanding court challenges to the notion that the president, President Bush, has this kind of power to declare U.S. citizens enemy combatants?
Again, there's not that issue is not squarely before any court at the current moment. When the Padilla case was about to go up before the Supreme Court, that was the moment at which the administration shifted tactics and decided to move Padilla out of a military brig. So the question never went up before the Supreme Court and bring him to federal court, where he faced criminal charges and was ultimately convicted. Again, showing the fact that, in fact, the criminal justice system does work, and it's possible to secure convictions of terrorists and suspected terrorists in the federal court system. And there's absolutely no justification for doing an end run around a system by creating an alternative lawless system of administrative detention.
Well, as we conclude here, Jennifer, I wanted to ask you this. Given that the Republican filibuster in the Senate prevented the restoration of habeas corpus for detainees on Guantanamo, are there any chances left before the next congressional election in November 2008 that Congress could find its way to restore habeas corpus to foreign-born detainees?
Well, we're seeing legislation move through the House right now. In fact, there's going to be a markup of habeas restoration legislation in the House Armed Services Committee and the House Judiciary Committee this Wednesday. And we are very hopeful that soon thereafter, in fact, possibly the following week, that legislation will be up on the House floor and that habeas restoration will win on the House floor. If that happens, there's still a possibility that habeas restoration legislation could be added onto the defense authorization bill or another bill, relevant bill, a defense appropriations bill perhaps, during the conference committee when the House and the Senate meet to resolve the differences in the two versions of the bill. So there is hope, and it's an issue that we will continue to press forward.
And before we say goodbye, how important is citizen action here? Obviously, a lot of this, the decisions are happening in the halls of Congress and in the courtroom, but what role can ordinary citizens and groups of citizens take to pressure the government to restore this age-old right of habeas corpus?
Well, I think citizen action is incredibly important. One of the unfortunate results of last week's vote is that the senator from Connecticut, Senator Lieberman, was the only Democrat to vote against habeas restoration. And if we are ever going to see this ancient writ restored and the law restored, the right of habeas restored, then it's important that those who voted against habeas restoration hear from citizens that and hear from his constituents that folks are not happy with his vote.
Indeed, that is the way politics works, and we can't be sure that'll always work with Senator Lieberman or some of the other stalwarts of supporters of the president's war on terrorism. But I thank you so much for taking time to explain a lot of this to us, Jennifer, and leave our listeners with a web address as well as a phone number or any other related information you want to give us.
Sure. Our web address is www.hrw.org, and our main headquarters in New York's main number is 212-216-1200.
Okay, that's hrw.org and the phone number in New York, area code 212-216-1200. Jennifer Daskal, thanks so much for being here with us tonight. Appreciate you making the time.
Thank you.
And thanks for all your hard work on these issues. They're
Thank
so important.
You.
Take care. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bars. Do you support the president and the war for oil? Do you think your sons belong? hear about Fallujah and 100,000 dead? Did you hear about the torture in the newspapers you read? Did you pretend it didn't matter? Did you blame a few bad men? Did you think your leaders would just do it all again? How far is it from here to Nuremberg? Software that ran the engine in the tank, or were you pushing papers at Citibank? Were you in Seattle turning bombers into gold, or did you pull the trigger because you did what you were told? How far is it from here to Nuremberg?
This is WPKN in Bridgeport, WPKM in Montauk. My name is Scott Harris. The program is Counterpoint, and we're here every Monday evening between 8 and 10 p.m. Glad you could be here with us, and we have a very exciting conclusion to our program right now. We'll be speaking with Marilyn Clement, National Coordinator of the group Healthcare Now. I just first of all want to remind you all to mark your calendar for a very important event that we're co-sponsoring here at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, as well as the Universal Healthcare Foundation of Connecticut. It's a public forum titled Healthcare, Basic Human Right or Privilege. We'll be hosting Dr. Stephanie Woolhandler, co-founder of the group Physicians for National Health Program and associate professor of medicine at Harvard University, along with John Wilhelm, president of the hospitality industry at Unite Here Union, an advocate of comprehensive health care for all. And we'll have a community panel of people to engage in some discussion along with the audience. And among that panel, just confirmed the other day, is State Representative Christopher Donovan, who is the majority leader in the House here in the state of Connecticut. And we'll have some health care providers and journalists as well. So this should be an interesting day. The date, of course, I don't want to leave that out. Saturday, October 13th. That's Saturday, October 13th, a few weeks from now, 2 to 4 p.m. at the United Church on the Green, and that's right on Temple Street in downtown New Haven. That's Saturday, October 13th, 2 to 4 p.m. More information at squeakywheel.net, squeakywheel.net, or go to the Between the Lines Radio News Magazine website, btlonline.org, and you get a connection right there. But again, I hope you'll make it there for this event, Healthcare Basic Human Right or Privilege, Saturday, October 13th, 2 to 4 p.m. Right now, I'd like to welcome to the program Marilyn Clement, National Coordinator of the group Healthcare Now. Thanks for joining us, Marilyn.
Hello. Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Yes.
Hello, Connecticut.
Well, you know, it's exciting times. It seems like universal healthcare is finally on the agenda of some politicians, at any rate. And the news media may not be doing a great job, but at least there's some coverage going on. But before we get into all what's happening now, tell us a little bit about your group, Healthcare Now.
Well, we started about between 3 and 4 years ago, depending on what you call starting it. But we decided that no one was really out here talking about a national single-payer healthcare system. And we felt like we needed to do that, that, you know, people were talking about, you know, Massachusetts and Maine and, you know, Tennessee and all different kinds of plans for a state by state, but that nobody was really talking about how do we get a national system that covers everybody. And so we started, and what we've done is a lot of first citizen congressional hearings, calling our congresspeople home to talk about it and to hear what the citizens have to say. And we did a year and a half of those, and then since that time, we've been doing truth hearings and really bringing more and more communities. So it's about 300 cities where we have events happening and hearings happening, and it's basically led by people within those communities. And then what's happening is that they're building within those communities coalitions to work for a national single-payer health care, and doing a lot of work with the media, doing a lot of letter writing. urging their congresspeople to sign on to Conyers H.R. 676. And we now have 82 co-sponsors plus Conyers as of this week. So it's coming along, and we're shooting for 100 co-sponsors by the first part of November, and then moving right on into, you know, a majority of Congress people by next year. So that's our plan,
mm-hmm.
and we feel like it's a going plan. And what's happening is that a lot of the national politicians are responding to that plan, somewhat, well, sort of buying in a little bit, certainly to universal. They never talked about universal there for a long time, and now everybody, including President Bush, is talking about universal health care under one or another plans. And then you've got pretty much everybody who's in the running in terms of the presidential campaign, you know, talking about leaving the insurance companies in the middle and in control of the healthcare system.
Right. Well, that's certainly one of the things I wanted to discuss with
yeah.
you, and that is Hillary Clinton, John Edwards, Barack Obama all have talked about some kind of universal health care plan that they are introducing. A lot of the details are vague in much of those plans, but the central idea of a universal system is there. But it does, as you just said, retains the central role of private insurance, the private insurance industry, you know, which in the view of many people in the healthcare field and advocates for universal healthcare feel is a huge part of the billions of dollars in extra expense in the, you know, multi-layered bureaucracy, which is not present in the Medicare plan for people of retirement age and older who have the benefit of a single-payer plan, you know, with Medicare. But tell us a little bit about, you think, the landscape. Now, I mentioned Hillary, John Edwards, Barack Obama. Dennis Kucinich, of course, is running for president, and he is an advocate of single-payer health care, and I believe he is a firm and strong supporter of the Conyers H.R. 676 bill.
Absolutely. And Dennis Kucinich, of course, probably because of that and his very firm stance against the war in Iraq, and basically says, you know, just cut off the funding and the war will end. Just cut off the funding except for bringing our folks home. So he does that, and he talks about health care for everybody and taking the insurance companies out of the control of the health care system and putting the pharmaceutical drug companies under a system where we negotiate from a position of power where all of us are in a huge pool, the hugest possible pool, 300 million of us, to be able to negotiate prices, not only for pharmaceutical drugs, but for a lot of other things, you know, medical equipment type things, durable medical equipment, MRIs, all kinds of things that we could save, you know, billions of dollars, you know, if we did that. And the other thing is, well, let me just say this, and then we can talk more about it. But of all the plans, all of these plans that are pretty much the same that leave the insurance companies in, and in some cases, like Hillary's plan, you know, mandate, force people to purchase insurance from the insurance companies. It's, you know, it's going to cost a lot more money and provide more money into the coffers of the insurance companies rather than what we would propose, which is to take them out and save about a third of the cost, which would then cover everybody without spending more money. So it's a win-win situation if we can put together a plan that is suitable for everybody. And Medicare for All improved and enhanced, and that's really important. We want Medicare to cover a whole lot more than it does at this point. So Medicare and everybody, you know, having the kinds of benefits that we should have with medical and dental and mental health care and drugs, prescription drugs and drug treatment and alcohol treatment, long-term care, all of those we could cover with the amount of money we are now spending and without, you know, spending more money. So that's our plan.
Marilyn, how did you get into all this, becoming the coordinator of healthcare now? What's been your experience with the healthcare system? Any stories there that got you active on this issue?
Well, two things. I worked for Dr. King in the last 2 years of his life before he was killed, so I was in Atlanta, and this was a very, very strong issue for him. He just felt that this would help us in terms of dealing with the inequality of the system more than almost anything, to have health care that was equal and affordable for everybody. And I do believe that's true, that it would make an incredible difference. You know, it would mean that people would have money in their pockets, they would have health, rather than being sick and not being able to afford to get the coverage that they need, to get the health care that they need.
I was just in Atlanta at the King Center there, and you know, toured the museum and saw the documentary films and read some of the documents there, and you know, I probably missed it. It's not, I guess, a well advertised fact about Dr. King and his agenda for a universal health care system.
Right, right. Well, it's not. It wasn't. I mean, it wasn't what you saw on television, but it was part of what he talked about in staff meetings and in his writings. It was not something that he talked about that much. But you know, one of the things people are seeing, and I'll talk a little bit more about me in a minute, but is the possibility now of actually winning a super majority in Congress next year that would be similar to the kind of super majority that was elected in 1964 that basically passed Medicare and also passed the Voting Rights Act and a lot of other good things, important things. And so people are saying, you know, given the disaster of the Bush administration, that this is a chance to really elect a progressive Congress. So we're going to be helping to do that with a roadshow. We're going across the country in four different sets of roadshows that we'll be going meeting with people around the country in city after city and every little town, sort of whistle stop. We need a whistle on the bus that we'll be taking, but we're going to take a bus with a caravan of cars behind it and maybe some antique cars and big old gas guzzler cars that are antiques, and basically say we need a 21st century healthcare system. So we'll have maybe some hybrid cars and some other things that are more what we need during this century.
Very good. Sounds good.
Same with the healthcare system.
Well, you know, there's been a lot of discussion in the media, aside from the presidential candidates and their universal healthcare plans that mostly retain the role of the private insurance industry. There are these state-by-state efforts. Mitt Romney, when he was governor of Massachusetts, helped pass this mandate that people in the state had to purchase private insurance. It was a mandate. Similar kind of plan with some differences is being debated and voted on in California. What about this state-by-state approach to universal health care? Just noting the fact that there was a single-payer route that was taken in Canada, that in one of the provinces that was a precursor of their national plan. Do you see any parallels here, or is it quite different?
Well, it's quite different. And in my view, the state-by-state approach really just wastes a lot of energies and diverts people's attention from what we really need as a nation. It's sort of, you know, it's what Michael Moore talks about in his film, you know, how do we get to we? You know, how do we become me all the time? And me in my state, or me in my county, or me in my, and, you know, some cities are talking about, well, let's try to cover health care for everybody in our city. And some islands like Cape Cod are saying, let's have a single-payer system for our island and so forth. And, you know, maybe they can get to something for their island or for their city. But what we really need in this country is something that brings us together. So that's, and so I think that, you know, let me talk about Saskatchewan, because that's where in Canada that was the first province to pass a single-payer system. Tommy Douglas was the great leader of Saskatchewan, and he was just revered by everybody. I mean, he really, he was a labor leader, and so he got the single-payer system passed in Saskatchewan, And then he became the Prime Minister of Canada and pushed and got it in the whole country. He was nominated and actually selected last year as the greatest person in the history of Canada by the people of Canada, partly because of that, partly because of his leadership in a lot of other areas. But we don't have any, I don't think there's a governor in the United States who either has that kind of respect and clout and organizing ability and will to do something like this. I don't think there's a one who has that kind of strength, the kind of strength that Tommy Douglas had. So we need, but what we need, you know, more than a leader to do this is we need to build a movement to do it. And so that's what we've been trying to do, is to build in every community. And we hope that there will be a lot of community groups, and I think there are beginning to be in Connecticut. I know there are in virtually every state in the country. We have groups that are organizing and helping to educate people as to how we could have health care for everybody,
mm-hmm.
not spend a bundle of more money, have much better health care for all of us if we remove the private sector from controlling it.
Well, I guess that my last question here is, and we don't have a lot of time left, but it seems like just as in 1994, you had a lot of these big insurance companies come to attack Hillary Clinton's plan, as it's been dubbed. Back then, you know, they had just millions of dollars to spend on advertising the infamous Harry and Louise ads. Just, and we're already seeing the kind of demonization of any kind of universal healthcare system, even retaining the central role of the insurance companies and not even going toward a single payer, you know, government-run system. You have this kind of categorical demonization from many of the Republicans and conservative columnists saying this is socialized medicine, which is just, you know, far-fetched and ridiculous given the timidity with which these plans have been put forward by the leading Democratic presidential candidates. But nonetheless, how do you think the battle will go between the well-moneyed, you know, with millions of dollars at their disposal, insurance companies and public opinion, which, if all the facts were laid out before them, I've seen some public opinion polls, people prefer a Medicare type of system.
Well, that's the thing. It's dependent on the level and the breadth of the kind of organizing that we do nationwide. And if we build the kind of movement that absolutely says to our congresspeople, this is what we want, this is what we need, this is what we must have, and either you have to move for what we want or you have to move out. And that's, you know, it's democracy, as Tony Benn said in the movie Sicko. Michael Moore asked him, well, how did you get this system in Britain, which had such a class system and had fine health care for the rich and nothing for the poor? And he said, we call it democracy, and it happened as a result of the war, of World War II, and we had come together as a nation to fight that war, and we said, well, what can we do to stay as a, you know, in the position of we, us together? And we decided to provide ourselves a national health care system. Just one other thing, we're really not talking about socialized medicine. We're not talking about a British system. We're talking about publicly funded, privately delivered, continuing to have private doctors. Everybody can choose their own doctor. So it's very different.
Well, as I said, there's a lot of misinformation out there, even about these timid Democratic plans.
Yeah, well, they're going to attack Hillary even though she's supporting them, even though they'll probably continue to give her, you know, millions and millions of dollars, and they'll attack her plan.
Which is just shows you, I guess that's what's frightening about the current situation in the United States, that, you know, someone just pops their head up with the eyebrows and the shots are fired. And, you know, the
right.
Full-fledged plan, which is, you know, to the benefit of the common good, is, you know, it's so far off the radar of the mainstream. And it shouldn't be. And that's, I guess, the problem here. And that's what we all got to fight for from the grassroots if we want to see it come into, to, you know, mainstream debate and actually get a vote on it. So.
And we're the only ones that can do it. It won't come from a presidential candidate or a president. It's got to come from the bottom up.
Well said, Marilyn. We'll have you back soon. We've got this health care forum coming up on the 13th, but I hope you'll keep in touch with us so we can know more about what you're doing. Connecticut.
Let me say one other thing.
Yeah,
Oprah,
go ahead.
Oprah, this Thursday, I think it's the 27th. Is that Thursday? Anyway, she's going to have Michael Moore, Dr. Linda Pino, and Steve Scazzara, the steelworker who spoke out at one of the debates. Be really important for people to watch that and respond to it.
Well, she got a big audience, so I'm glad she's doing it.
Yep.
All right. Well, it's 10 o'clock, Marilyn. I'm going to say goodnight. Give us your web address, a phone number, anything you'd like to leave
it's,
our listeners with.
www.healthcare-now.org. And the phone number is 212-475-8350.
All right. Marilyn, thanks so much for being here tonight.
Good luck.
All right. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye. Marilyn Clement, National Coordinator of the group Healthcare Now. It's healthcare-now.org. And it's 10 p.m. This is WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM, WPKM in Montauk at 88.7 FM. Thanks for listening tonight. Contribute what you can to the survival of this radio station, listener-supported radio station. Some of the interview segments heard here are edited and used in our nationally syndicated Between the Lines radio news magazine. Go to that website. You can get transcripts, audio downloads, and the like. It's www.btlonline.org. WhiteRoseSociety.org, that's the website. You can get the full two-hour audio archive of each and every Monday evening's Counterpoint program. That's WhiteRoseSociety.org. And if you want to email me directly about any suggestions for topics and guests, you can email me at betweenthelines@snet.net. WPCAN.org is the web address of this radio station. Get our schedule at that address and lots more. JF is next, so do stay tuned. He'll be up in just a moment. Stay tuned.
It's hard to rattle your saber when you're in bed with the enemy. Everyone tattling up favors and kissing you just like it's Gethsemane. All these oil men drooling over what might happen, lying in their beds of cool white satin, following the money, bailing over any port, folio in a storm. You're in bed with the enemy. You're Enron, WorldCom.com, bubble burst. You banged up this Barbie in a whole lot of trouble. Said your money's on the dresser and I'm done with you. But she's not moving out. She's in love with you. You're in bed with the enemy. You almost washed up in Florida, got caught in the rigging of the little black holes. Was it Gonzalez or Batista? They all look the same when you pander to the polls. Got the whole world focused on a misplaced cigar, so no one noticed hands in the cookie jar. Your brother working mojo with his Midas touch, so why you think your daughters drink so much? You're in bed with the enemy. This Barbie in a whole lot of trouble. Said your money's on the dresser and I'm done with you. But she's not moving out. She's in love with you. You're in bed with the enemy. Texas, where
your daddy drove his Studebaker car, trading domicile for physical nexus, while you were in the frat house playing air guitar. Now you wanna go to war with a cool coward's vengeance, get their minds off elections and their bottomed out pensions. Your blue blood boiling with cowboy condescension, but you forget we've seen chicken hawks before. You're in bed with the enemy. Your Enron WorldCom.com bubble burst. You banged up this Barbie in a whole lot of trouble. Said your money's on the dresser and I'm done with you. But she's not moving out. She's in love with you. You're in bed with the enemy. 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 You're in bed with the enemy.
No, I'm not. I'm in bed with Ruby LaFay. Well, maybe not right now, but I was in bed with Ruby LaFay sometime or other, and I'm Nasmo King, and I'll be your host till 2 o'clock in the morning, and then Doug will be here. Hey, I got to tell you something before I start anything. The Connecticut Air and Space Center is having a open house this Saturday. Yes, the one in Stratford on the east side of the Sikorsky Memorial Airport. And that is going to be from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. It's on Sniffins Lane. So if you get off of exit 30, north or southbound, and head east, that's towards the Ramada Inn. And when you get to the fork in the road, take the one to the left. It'll end at a light, and there'll be Enterprise Rent-A-Car on your right-hand side, an empty lot, and the merchants walk and make a right. And the second light, you'll see it on the left-hand side at the end of the big building. You'll see a sign, make a left, and you'll find parking on the right-hand side. We're the only building on the right-hand side. You're more than welcome to come in. And the only restriction is you have to be over 16 because of the remediation of the Army base. That's about it. So welcome one and all. See some bits of history. Be in the building that where the Corsair F4U used to be made. If you had been to our Corsairs over Connecticut 2 years ago, you didn't have an opportunity of going through the plant. Well, now you can. There'll be other people there besides myself to instruct you, tell you about the history of the plant, other things, what we would like to do. So if you have any questions, you can call 380, it's a 203 area code, 1400. You can leave a message. There isn't anything on the website, but you can come on down. That's Saturday, 9 a.m. to 1 p.m., the Stratford and Engine Plant, that's what they called it, on the south end of Main Street, the east side of Sikorsky Airport. And there's one other thing you can do. It's this Wednesday at 4:30 at the Innovation Center in Bridgeport, and that's on Connecticut Avenue, 955 Connecticut Avenue, which is also able to be reached north or southbound from exit 30, except you're not going to take Lordship Boulevard towards the Stratford Engine Plant. You're going to head north to Stratford Avenue and make a left. And in two or three lights, you'll see it. On the right-hand side, find a parking space where on the left, it'll be outdoors. There'll be a press conference. The Society for Environmental Justice has gotten a grant to do some more studies about the EPA and the community there in Bridgeport. There will be a community tour of Bridgeport, and I took this one tour back in January, and I've been with them ever since. And, well, you can go to their website, environmental-justice.org, or you can call Catherine up at 203-362-1133. 3-8. So the press conference and the community meeting will be between 4:30 and 6. And the bus tour will be between 6 and 7. And then it's that crepuscular time of the night. Let's see if I can get this straight.
WPKN's open format allows for many individual views and opinions. But the views and opinions expressed are those of the people expressing them, not WPKN itself. If you wish to respond with your viewpoint, call the general manager weekdays from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. at area code 203-331-9756 or send an email to wpkn@wpkn.org.
Yeah, there's one other thing. The Society for Environmental Justice, the Connecticut Coalition for Environmental Justice, is having their third annual conference, and it's Saturday, October 27th. Yes, you have a month to plan that. From 8:30 to 5 p.m. at UConn School of Business at 100 Constitution Plaza. And that's in Hartford. And registration should be sent in September. There we go. The keynote speakers will be Tom Goldtooth and Senator Tony Harp. And for more information, you can contact Dawn Simonson at 860-548-1133. Or you can go to the website CCEJ at environmental-justice.org. And I'll let you know about a few things from there. It's also, I have a friend that is a baseball player, and he reads a lot, and he reads baseball stories, and he's played softball and stuff. And matter of fact,